Will you be voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump in November, and why? What's your reaction to Hillary Clinton's double-digit lead over Donald Trump, according to the latest Marquette University Law School poll? Do you think she has Wisconsin wrapped up, or can Trump overcome that lead somehow? Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, August 11th. We will analyze the presidential and the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin as it stands right now and talk about other results from the latest Marquette University Law School poll. Plus, our guest will also discuss with us some of the other issues making news on the campaign trail. Join in with your questions, your reactions, your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'll talk about the poll results first, but a little later we'll get into the issue of the controversial Second Amendment comments made by Donald Trump earlier this week. Was he suggesting that gun rights advocates do harm to Hillary Clinton, or did he just mean politically they might be able to stop her by not electing her? What do you think about that? We'll talk about that in just a bit. Charles Franklin is our guest, director of the Marquette University Law School Poll, professor of law and public policy. He is the co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good to be back.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So it looks like Hillary Clinton has opened up a pretty sizable lead over Donald Trump here in Wisconsin. She leads by 10 points among registered voters and 15 points among likely voters. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's a striking margin. Anytime you're up into double digits, it's impressive. With registered voters, that's an uptick of 4 points from before the conventions when she led by 6. But the more striking number is among likely voters. In July, she led by just 4 points among likely voters. Now it's by 15. The thing about likely voters is it shifts all the time because it depends on who is absolutely sure they'll go to the polls. That's our definition of a likely voter. And so that can ebb and flow as events happen and as one side gets more energized and the other less. Right now, the advantage is going to the Democrats. Democrats are a little more likely to say they're certain to vote. And Democrats are also a little more voting in the party line. 90% of Democrats voting for Clinton, just 79% of Republicans voting for Trump. And so that's where we're getting these differences between registered and likely voters. I think if you want the longer term status of the race, I look at the registered voters. But as we get closer and closer to Election Day, the likely voters become a better indicator of turnout and actual vote when we're in, say, in September and after.
You said only 79% of Republicans said that they would vote for Trump. Have we ever seen that before?
That's an unusually low number. It was 80% last month. And it's because not very many are crossing over to Hillary Clinton. It's just about a 6% of Republicans voting for Clinton. But we get a large percentage saying they will vote for neither, they won't vote, they don't know. And when we add the options of Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, and Jill Stein, the Green Party, and give people a choice of all four, Johnson and Stein get a fair bit of the vote, 10 and 4% or a little less on likely voters. But the margin between Clinton and Trump remains about the same. It's 13 points with likely voters, for example. When you include Johnson and Stein, it's 15 without them. So you see, it's not really shifting the margins in the race between the top two very much. Mostly, Johnson and Stein are picking up undecided, won't vote neither. But the irony is, even when you offer all four candidates, we still have 10% or more who say, I'm not satisfied with any of those four choices.
Yeah. Did you say Jill Stein had 4%?
About 4% with one measure And I think it's 4% with registered voters, 3% with likely.
And Gary Johnson had 10%.
10 and drops to 9.
Yeah.
Very little difference
yeah,
there.
So, do we know, for instance, for the Jill Stein supporters, those are just independents, or are they disaffected Bernie Sanders supporters?
Yeah, we don't know specifically whether they're Sanders supporters or not. It's a small percentage. And it does, and it seems to come more from those who are in the neither category rather than being, say, Clinton voters when you only offer two choices who leave Clinton to come to Stein. That doesn't seem to be that much. It's really those dissatisfied with their other choices.
Yeah. So how much of Hillary Clinton's double-digit lead can be attributed to a favorable post-convention bounce?
I think, first of all, it is always the case that the party that goes second in the conventions gets a little bit better opportunity because they get to damp down whatever bounce there was from the first convention as well as add on their own effect of boosting their side. So in that sense, the Democrats came out, in a sense, structurally ahead of the game by going second. That said, there's evidence in our data that the Democrats came out of their convention telling us they were more united, telling us that the divisions in the party would be taken care of by then, and that the party would unite if it wasn't already united, compared to where they were before the convention. So it's clear that happened. On the Republican side, though, there was almost no movement in the sense that the party's united, with still 46% saying the party's divided and will remain so through Election Day. So in that sense, the Democratic convention achieve the goal of uniting the party in a way the Democrats did not. It's also important to recognize that we were in the field doing our survey last Thursday through Sunday. At the end of a week for Donald Trump of campaigning after the convention that included numerous controversies over the Khan's speech at the convention about their son who was killed in Afghanistan, which continued throughout the early part of the week, and also included Trump's decision to say he wasn't ready to endorse Paul Ryan. And Paul Ryan statewide has an 80% approval in the state among Republicans. So it was really as bad a week for Donald Trump on the campaign trail as you can expect.
Yeah.
So I think we're seeing here in these data a combination of both a successful Democratic convention and a bad week for Donald Trump.
Yeah, there was that dispute with the Gold Star parents. His joke about getting the Purple Heart, remember that, where he said, you know, boy, this is a lot easier for this vet to give me the Purple Heart. He did kind of ridicule a woman with a crying baby at one of his campaign rallies. He got a lot of negative reaction to that. And as you said, not endorsing Paul Ryan right away in his primary race. He's in more hot water this week. He just can't seem to. Is he misspeaking all the time? Do his supporters like this? Yeah. Is the media overblowing this?
I think it is certainly fair to say that this is the Donald Trump that we saw through the primaries, who could say things in spontaneous ways at rallies that got him in trouble, or that at least focused attention to him. Maybe that's the other side of this. They say that no, all publicity is good publicity. That's a highly debated argument, but Donald Trump does thrive in being on the center of attention, and these kinds of statements get him there, for better or for worse. But I think that this week now, which has nothing to do with our polling because it's after it, is a good example where he gave a very scripted speech on economic policy in Detroit. He stayed on message through that script. He read it from a teleprompter. That's the more conventional politician who wants to say just what the campaign has agreed he should say. And he stuck to that message for practically the entire day and then tweeted something a bit controversial in the afternoon, and then the next day made this comment about the Second Amendment, the supporters of the Second Amendment. which was, if you watch the video, seemed like a throwaway line. It was like it occurred to him and he said it. But then the campaign said, oh, no, that's not at all what he meant. And people raised questions about if saying things that, no matter how you intended them, raise an issue, which is an awfully serious issue, that presidential candidates and presidents need to realize their words have meaning and matter.
Yeah. Hillary Clinton yesterday said that Donald Trump once again crossed the line. Donald Trump is saying, give me a break. I wasn't promoting violence against Hillary Clinton. I was saying that Second Amendment supporters could stop her politically by voting against her.
And it would have been easy to say, you should organize and vote against her.
Yeah.
That's not what
yeah.
he said.
Well, what do you think about that controversy? What do you think about these results from the Marquette University Law School poll? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are discussing the latest issues making news on the campaign trail this hour, including the results of the just released Marquette University Law School poll. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He's also a professor of law and public policy. The poll, among other things, shows that Hillary Clinton holds a 52-37% lead over Donald Trump among likely voters. So we're talking about what to attribute that double-digit lead. And I also wanted to ask you, Professor Franklin, whether does this mean that Hillary Clinton has things wrapped up in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's a little early to say that it's wrapped up. I think the important way to look at this is that if we look at presidential elections since we've had good polling throughout the process, they vary a lot. You don't see one person hold the same lead through the entire election. Even when we've seen pretty solid wins, it moves up and down and it varies. Let me give the best example. In 2012, right after the Democratic convention, at the beginning of the campaign here, our Marquette Law School poll showed Barack Obama ahead of Romney by 13 percentage points, not far from the 15 we see right now. But a few weeks later, after the first presidential debate, which by all accounts did not go well for President Obama.
That's right, he blew that one.
He led by just 1% in our next mm-hmm. poll. Then he worked his way back up, and ultimately, we said he would win by 8%. He actually won the state by 7%. So I think there you see a good example of how much variation there is. Coming off a good convention, and this year, a bad week of campaigning, you see the Democratic margin go quite a ways up, just as Obama's did in 2012. But events can happen during the course of the campaign, like a bad debate, that can move those numbers quite a bit. And it wasn't just in Wisconsin in 2012 that those numbers moved. They moved in parallel across all of the 15 battleground states that we have good polling for, as well as the national numbers. So I just encourage people to realize that this is a dynamic process, and you may think it's all baked in right now, but history says this can move around quite a bit over the course of the fall.
Yeah, and Trump's not giving up. Trump's running mate Mike Pence is scheduled to hold a town hall at UW-La Crosse this afternoon. He's also expected to appear in Milwaukee tonight. This will be his fourth stop in Wisconsin in the past 3 weeks. So is there something that Trump-Pence can do to turn things around?
Well, I think coming to the state and waging an active campaign here is one of those things. It's always important to look at the candidates and what are they doing? Where are they investing their time? And more typically, their advertising. But the Trump campaign has done so little advertising, we're really not getting clues for their strategy from advertising. But rather, where do they allocate the candidates' time? You know, you can move money around to buy TV here or there, But the most limited resource that a campaign has is the time of the candidate. So where does Donald Trump go? Where does Hillary Clinton go? Where do the two vice presidential candidates go? Both parties have paid significant attention to Wisconsin. And remember, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were supposed to be here for their first joint event in Green Bay, but it came after the Orlando shootings, and they canceled that event. I don't know if they'll reschedule an event here or not, but the fact that we've seen Tim Kaine in the state as the vice presidential candidate certainly shows that attention is being paid. And I believe Kaine is scheduled to make another visit, I think, to Madison soon.
So would you still call Wisconsin a battleground state?
Well, at 15 percentage point margin, no, or even at the 10 that we see for registered voters. But not being a battleground doesn't mean that it couldn't become a battleground. If you look at the Electoral College map and say, from Donald Trump's point of view, what states would I need to win to get a majority of the Electoral College? One of those strategies is the so-called Midwest strategy. Win Pennsylvania, win Ohio, win Michigan, win Wisconsin. You've then put together a string of states that are normally blue, but which have a more white electoral makeup, have a bit more of a blue-collar makeup. Those are areas of strength for Trump. So the theory at least goes that you could put that string together and be more competitive in the Electoral College. Wisconsin would then be a very important part of that kind of strategy.
We have some callers, so let's go to Gary in Glendale first. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you, and Professor Franklin. Nationally, I was able to learn that the Clinton-Sanders vote total of 30 million far outpolled the Trump-Cruz vote total of 22 million. Professor Franklin, do you have any figures on Wisconsin and how in the primary that same combination would have been vis-a-vis each other?
Right. The in the primary here, the total Republican vote was about 1.1 million, and the total Democratic vote was just over 1 million. So the two were quite close combined. I don't have broken out separately for each individual candidate. I'm sorry, I can't tell you that. But remember that these are primary votes, which are going to be, as a percentage, just a fraction of the total vote that we see in the fall. So there was a surge nationally in Republican turnout this year, while Democratic turnout was fairly high but below what it had been in 2008 when Obama and Clinton ran a marathon campaign all the way to June. But that primary turnout historically is interesting within the party but has not been predictive of turnout in those states when we come to November. We will have something on the order of 130 to 140 million votes cast this fall, which will dwarf the total turnout in the primaries.
Typically, more Democrats, at least in Wisconsin, turn out on a presidential election day than Republicans?
There's a considerable surge between the midterm elections and the presidential year. We for the last several elections, have been right about 3 million total voters on presidential election day in November. Compare that with the about 2 million, 2.1 million that turned out for our primary, which is actually very high. That's a big turnout. But in 2010, for example, for the gubernatorial race, it was just 2.1 million. For the recall, it was 2.5, I believe. So we will see something like a 20 or 30% increase in turnout this November compared to the turnout we saw in the 2014 gubernatorial election. Now, that won't be all new Democratic voters, of course. It'll be a mix of Democrats and Republicans. But historically, Democrats have done a bit better in presidential races at turning out their forces and a bit worse at turning out Democrats in midterms.
Can we do any predicting that maybe some unsatisfied Republicans and Democrats won't be turning out because of their selections.
There's certainly the notion that in both parties, the divisions within the party meant that turnout could drop off. We see that in the sense that 14 to 16% of our samples still say they're unsatisfied with the choices that they have. When we look at the history of voting going all the way back to the 1950s, we see that people are unhappy with their, who are unhappy with their choices are both more likely to delay making a decision in the campaign and are more likely to ultimately choose not to vote at all rather than go to the polls and vote for either someone they don't like or vote for a third-party candidate as a protest vote.
We are talking about the presidential race, the latest Marquette University Law School numbers on the presidential race, talking about issues making news on the campaign trail in the presidential race. During this segment, we will talk more about the U.S. Senate race and some other poll results coming up after our news break. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mary in Manitowoc is with us now. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I was just earlier you were commenting on Donald Trump and his rhetoric and his mouth, whatever he does. But my concern is that with the children in our country, they hear this man say these things and they hear their parents say things about Trump and that little boy that was blurting out that terrible phrase during one of Trump's rallies, it bothers me because it concerns me about, you know, this year the kids are going to be starting school, and I worry for teachers and, you know, people in the educational field that they, you know, they're going to hear this from children because some parents, you know, they just don't care what they say in front of their kids, so I'm hoping that something could be done about, you know, in the educational arena to help combat this.
Well,
Donald
that would,
Trump.
I thank you very much, Mary. I'm just imagining, though, that there'd be a big political fight over that if teachers are going to say, anti-Donald Trump stuff in the school, in the classroom.
I think the issue more broadly is that political rhetoric has coarsened in many ways over the last 15 or 20 years. We saw in the Bush administration what came to be called Bush derangement syndrome, as folks on the left said amazing things about then President Bush. Certainly during the Obama years, we've seen Republicans say amazing things about the president. Now this year, a more unconstrained rhetoric, certainly on the presidential campaign trail. It's not as if American politics used to be a wonderful place where we only said nice things about each other. That's surely not the case. But this year, we have seen a variety of rhetorical approaches, including at the Republican convention in Chris Christie's speech, which encouraged the crowd to yell "lock her up" repeatedly over the course of that. And it's now routine to hear rhetoric call the Democratic nominee a criminal. There is certainly an intense argument on the right about whether Clinton's handling of emails should have been taken to criminal charges. But that's an argument, and yet we hear these intense chants about her at rallies. Yeah. That rhetoric is, I think, the background behind this week's controversy about what Trump said about Second Amendment supporters and what he meant by it. It would look very different if the background was not one of chants of lock her up, calling Hillary Clinton a traitor and the like.
And Mary, concerned that his rhetoric and behavior will rub off on children. The Clinton campaign certainly thinks that, too. That's one of the ads that they continue to run, that our children are watching, our children are listening.
Of course. And let's realize that their approach to this is as a political issue for them. They believe Donald Trump is vulnerable because of his language, and they're making commercials for their own benefit to play up that rhetoric. So this is the nature of the Trump campaign, that conventional campaigns would not think that kind of rhetoric is to their benefit. But this year, the Trump campaign has been successful either despite or because of his unrestrained rhetoric that his supporters say is a breath of fresh air, not politically correct. And so it's important to realize that there are two sides to this argument, I think.
Let's take a call from Gary in Merrill. Hello, Gary.
Yes, good morning. Well, I hope the voters don't overlook the obvious, and that is this connection between Hillary, well, and her husband and the Bushes. So George Bush, the younger one, and with the CIA, they decided to topple all these regimes in the Middle East. So George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, and now Obama and Hillary, they have left a trail of death and destruction in five countries in the Middle East. And now Syria, it's just unrelenting. She needs to be blamed for that. The blood is on her shoulders. Certainly with Libya, she jumped up and down. She was so happy when Gaddafi was killed and burned. And she needs to be held accountable. I think both her and Bush should be before a world court for war crimes.
All right, Gary. What about that belief?
Well, I think actually this is the sort of argument that we could have a productive discussion of this year. I would frame it a little differently, but the point here, and the New York Times has a big article today on how the Arab world came apart, a review of the last 13 years of what has happened in the Middle East over that period, which covers both administrations that Gary's talking about. The question of what should be the U.S.'s strategic role in the world, what policy decisions have we made over the last 15 or 16 years that we should look back on with regret now, and how should that inform our future policy? Maybe it's just an ivory tower academic that thinks, you know, that's an important discussion to have. But in who do you blame for disasters, we don't have that kind of discussion. I think both parties have shared, certainly over this time, in some good decisions and some bad decisions in this area. I believe the society would benefit from appreciating both the good and the bad of what we've done. Yeah. But it's very hard to have that discussion in a political campaign under the best of circumstances.
Well, Donald Trump yesterday made another controversial comment. He, in essence, said President Obama and crooked Hillary Clinton co-founded ISIS. And that's the headline in NPR News even this morning.
And here you go again, if I can use that phrase, with language which surely is not intended literally. There's not a document of incorporation that says, I found ISIS. But the broader argument about whether policies of the administration have made the development of ISIS more likely or more possible, and a counter-argument that ISIS arises out of the rubble of the Iraq War, to push this back to the previous administration, those, I think, are fairly legitimate arguments to have about has our policy been a good policy or a bad policy. But when Trump phrases it in the way of saying Obama founded ISIS, then that's clearly literally false. But does it reach to a bigger point? I noticed a tweet yesterday from someone saying that even when Trump takes a kernel of truth, he wraps it in a rhetoric that makes it hard to come to that kernel. Well, here the kernel would be the policy debate. Have we followed smart or poor policies in dealing with ISIS? But as soon as you personalize it and say Obama founded ISIS, this is taking away from the possibility of a serious discussion of the issue.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we have a couple of more interesting results from the Marquette University Law School poll on issues in the presidential race that we wanted to talk about before getting into the U.S. Senate race. We have Russ Feingold also has a pretty big lead over Ron Johnson. We'll talk more about that after the news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Charles Franklin, who is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. We're talking about the latest Marquette poll results and some of the issues making news on the campaign trail. And we're welcoming your questions and your thoughts and views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So, Professor Franklin, we talked about Donald Trump's controversial rhetoric and comments regarding the Second Amendment, for example, and how he says that people who believe in the Second Amendment might be able to stop Hillary Clinton from appointing judges to the Supreme Court. He says he meant that in a political aspect. Others were concerned he was threatening or inciting violence against Hillary Clinton. A couple of things. Conservatives have been pointing to a comment that Clinton made in May of 2008 when then-Senator Barack Obama had pretty much wrapped up the nomination, but she refused to concede. In an interview, she recalled how her husband Bill in 1992 won California in the middle of June and that Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated in California in June after winning the state's primary. Now, you're not a media analyst, but is there a big difference between what Trump said in his clumsy statement, if you want to call it that, and what Clinton had said?
I think what we see is politicians have a long history of misstatements, moments when they say something which is construed or might be construed in a particular way. With Clinton, it was that one about Bobby Kennedy. Just this week in the Senate race in Ohio, we saw a candidate say that Justice Scalia had died at a good time in the context of decisions that were coming up and how it affected it. That's a terrible thing to say. But what you normally see is an acknowledgement that I misspoke. I apologize if I offended people. It was not my intention. And so typically the dance of rhetoric is when you go too far backing away from it. What the Trump campaign has done, which is typical of other rhetoric that they've used, is the strategy of doubling down on it and saying, no, that's not what we meant. It's a distortion to say that's what we meant. Here's what we really meant. But that keeps the controversy going rather than damping it down. And it's why the conventional wisdom is you want the story to go away, not prolong it into a second or third or fourth day.
The other story that came out yesterday that Donald Trump was also pointing to, saying, hey, give me a break. I didn't mean anything by those Second Amendment comments. And how come you in the media are not focusing in on these emails that he claims show Hillary Clinton was involved in pay for play?
Well, there are several things going on here that, again, the sort of conventional political analysis would say Clinton has some vulnerabilities that have come up even in just the last couple of weeks that a more conventional campaign would have been able to pounce on if it weren't for the distractions that we've seen on issues generated by the Trump campaign. One of those was Clinton saying that the FBI director had said she had been completely truthful. That turned out to be something that they had to walk back and say, well, he said she had not, they had no indication that she had been untruthful in her interviews with the FBI. But the way she had said it applied to all of her statements. Well, that's a controversial and important part of the argument about how she handled her her emails. But because we were focused on the Trump campaign, that point was not well made. Now, in the last day or two, we've seen a conservative activist group that's been suing Clinton release some emails with the State Department that suggest connections between the Clinton Foundation, Bill Clinton's foundation, and State Department. Again, whether they do or don't represent a serious conflict, I have no idea. But as a political issue, that could be at the forefront of discussion this week, but for the focus on things that Trump has said.
You asked some other public policy issues that I do want to try to get to, but we've gone almost the whole hour and we haven't even gotten to the poll results when it comes to the U.S. Senate race between Republican incumbent Senator Ron Johnson and his challenger, former Democratic Senator Russ Feingold. What's going on there?
Here, the race is a 6-point Feingold lead with registered voters and an 11-point Feingold lead with likely voters. Two ways to look at that. One is both of those are 4 points smaller than we see in the presidential race. So we do see a tighter Senate race compared to the presidential by the same 4-point difference between them. The 6-point margin with registered is almost the same as the 7-point last month. But the likely voter has increased the margin from 5 to 11 points. That's because of the same thing we were talking about earlier on the presidential side, the greater motivation and activism or activation of Democrats to turn out to vote. So it's giving the Democrats in the Senate and in the presidency a little bit of an advantage there on turnout. We don't see much change at all in perceptions of Senator Johnson compared to a month ago. But Senator Feingold's favorable ratings went up by 4 points, and so did his unfavorable ratings, which suggests there's beginning to be a little bit of movement in the perceptions of Feingold, but it, at least by this measure, was equally positive and negative, both of those going up by 4 points. Last thing, with two presidential candidates who are seen much more unfavorably than favorably, it's perhaps notable that both Feingold and Johnson are seen on balance more favorably than unfavorably.
You also asked about Governor Walker's job performance. He dropped out of the presidential race nearly a year ago, and his approval rating is still below 40%. It's 38% approval rating, 59% disapproving. Why isn't that figure moving any at all?
It really is striking that it's been in the mid to upper 30s for over a year now, with disapproval in the mid-50s most of that time, without strong trends. I think part of the story is from the time he dropped out of the presidential race, most of our political attention this year has been focused elsewhere, either on the presidential or on the Senate race. We don't have a race now. The legislature's not in session. There's not a budget to be considered or any of those things. The governor has been traveling around the state holding a lot of events, some open and some closed to the public. But it hasn't really moved his approval numbers. I think we're beginning to see the ramp up of discussion of policy and the budget for the coming year. That will come to a head in February when the governor presents his budget. And I would look to the late fall, early winter as the time when attention turns from the national races and comes back home, and then we could see movement in perceptions of him, the performance of the legislature, and it won't be too early to start speculating about the gubernatorial race.
Well, one of those budget issues involves the transportation funding. I know that the governor has said, I don't want to raise fees or taxes, but others, even in his own party, are saying, hey, you know, the roads are crumbling. We need to do something about this. There might even be budget proposals to increase fees and taxes. So what do our poll respondents say here?
Well, this is striking. We gave the three options. Would you increase revenue through taxes or licensing? 43% say they would do that in order to maintain current road projects. 33% say they would cut spending to avoid any tax increases, which would mean limiting those road projects. And 12% were willing to borrow all or most of the money we need. And the money's not inconsiderable. The current estimate is $939 million shortfall in the road budget next year. That's on a par with the $1.3 billion the governor initially proposed borrowing in the current budget, which ultimately we borrowed $850 million. However, there's a deep party divide here. 55% of Republicans would cut spending on roads rather than increase revenues or borrow. 59% of Democrats would raise revenues. So a sharp partisan division there. In that sense, the governor's position of doing this through cutting projects has majority support within his party. Independents, 45% would raise revenue.
So if our legislature and governor are looking at these poll results, what are we going to see happen?
Well, I think this is the dilemma we've seen with road funding for a long time. The governor is strongly opposed to increasing net taxes to do this. Some Republican legislators, starting last year, are very reticent to see the continued borrowing for roads, but they're also unhappy with the idea that road construction might come to a halt or be scaled back, especially in their area of the state. So there's a division within the party on this, and I really think we're looking at the next 6 to 8 months as the party and the governor negotiate about how do we sustain roads. The last thing, public opinion is fickle. Whenever we've asked about borrowing, it's been very unpopular, like the only 12% that say we should borrow. But at the end of the last two budgets, when borrowing was the last resort, we saw approval of doing that rise to near or just over 50%. So when push comes to shove, borrowing may be the least objectionable.
Boy, we have just a minute. Anything else from yesterday's poll that we didn't cover that you think people should know about?
I think one that we have not done is about the issue of Muslim Americans. And this came up in the Trump campaign about whether we should ban Muslims from entering the country. But it also comes up in how we treat Muslim Americans. We asked, which comes closer to your view, Muslim Americans are loyal citizens and allies in the war on terror, or Muslim Americans need to be subjected to special scrutiny because of the threat of terrorism? 65% said loyal citizens, 24% said special scrutiny. So that's putting in a little bit of perspective how the public in Wisconsin at least feels about the issue.
Yeah. So how important are these presidential debates going to be, do you think?
Well, if they happen, and there's a little bit of doubt about that, I think we have seen in the past debates that produce big movements. And most importantly, in Donald Trump's case, can he establish himself through that debate as someone people trust with the presidency? One of the biggest divides we see in our data is who's qualified to be president. He suffers. She's strong on that. Debates could, in principle, change that perception.
We shall see in both cases. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. Thanks to producers Bill Martins, Brianne Chasseau, and Nyasia Ellison. This is the Ideas Network.